Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Well, good morning, everyone. You're tuned to Community Radio 3CR. Time is just after 7:30. And, of course, it's time for the 3CR Gardening Show. And today we have a very, very special program to celebrate International Day of People with Disability. I must firstly, before I continue, say a big thank you to AB, who was filling in for me while I was overseas. Thanks, AB. But today, as I said, we have a very, very special program. And I've got three very special guests in the studio who are going to be adding a lot to the discussion for the day. First up, I have to welcome Stephen Wells. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, Pam. How are you?
Good. Now, Stephen, just to let our listeners know, although you've been on the show before, you're a horticultural therapist, you're a registered nurse, in fact, you're a clinical nurse specialist. You're also Gardens and Grounds Project Officer with Austin Health.
I am, yes. I have a few hats to wear during my working week in each of those roles during the course of the week, which is pretty exciting.
Absolutely. And just on the side, you've been the recipient of a Churchill Fellowship.
Yes, yes.
Fantastic. And when you've got other time, you design gardens and you also write for Garden Drum.
Yeah, we try and fit as much into life as I can. Life is to be enjoyed and jammed as much as we can in.
Absolutely. Well, you know, that keeps you very busy.
It does, but a good busy.
Fantastic. Basil, Natoli, welcome.
Good morning, Pam.
Haven't seen you for a while, but you've also been in on the program before.
Pam, it's wonderful to be here and to share in the excitement this morning of talking about people and gardens and people of all abilities having access to gardens.
Absolutely. Now, you are currently teaching at three different schools.
I'm a permanent member of the education department and I work in three special settings: at Croxton Special in Northcote, Springvale Park SDS in Springvale, and Monash SDS. And in each of those places, I work in the garden with the kids. So my days are fully engaging with the children, and I'm loving it.
Fantastic. Now, previously too, you also were very heavily involved in getting children in Royal Children's Hospital, potting up and then gardening, and you also helped the Children's Hospital to realise how much and how therapeutic having a hospital garden was for patients to walk in.
And in fact, last week, Pam, or 2 weeks ago, I was emceeing at the Botanic Gardens at the statewide awards event for VSGA.
Yes.
And I was sharing with the kids a story of bringing one of the boys down, one of the patients from 3 East, bringing he and his mum down to the garden after he'd been in traction for about 6 or 8 weeks. And in the middle of winter, but it was a magical winter's day, and the joy that this boy and his mum experienced at getting out of the hospital and into the garden. So that was very, very exciting. And, Carolyn Blackman was there as well. And Carolyn also shared her experiences of helping me with the kids in the garden at the Children's.
Fantastic. And finally, you also helped set up a group called Cultivating Community. And, of course, they manage the community gardens on Melbourne's public housing estates, and dealing with a lot of newcomers to Australia who have a range of disabilities but still love to garden.
Yeah, and as you know some of those characters very intimately,
oh,
Pam.
Yes.
And just 2 weeks ago I went to, I was a special guest at the 20th birthday celebration of the community garden at Atherton Gardens in Fitzroy, and Peter Christensen and her fellow workers from Cultivating Community and the tenants on the estate in Fitzroy had a big, big garden celebration, a big garden party, and we shared lots of stories. And some of those characters, even in the little community garden in Dyett Street in Collingwood, are still there.
Wow.
Keeping the Cultivating Community workers on their toes.
I bet they are. That's fantastic. Now, thirdly, I must introduce you to Josh Fergus. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning. How are you going?
Fine. And Josh, you're CEO at something called Kevin Hines Grow.
That's right, yeah.
Okay. And I gather as well as Kevin Hines Grow, there's also like an offshoot of that. called Humanscape.
Humanscape, yeah, that's right.
Yep. Okay, so and as well as that, you've worked in child and family welfare, with disability, in public health. You're a counsellor.
Mm-hmm.
So how come everyone in this room is so busy? Everyone's so involved. It's incredible.
I think it's a passion for community, Pam. I mean, it's very similar to what Stephen was saying. You know, life's there for living and seeing what you can develop and what you can grow and, you know, what we can inspire in our communities. And I think a love of nature is very much a part of that. But, yeah, I've worked right across social services, right across, you know, wherever people might need a helping hand. And or there's some difficult social problems to tackle. That's what I'm interested in.
I noticed you've been heavily involved with foster care too.
Yes, for many years. I come from a fostering family. My mother's been fostering since I was about 12 years old.
Wow.
So grown up with that in the blood, I suppose.
Yes.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Okay. Can we start with Kevin Hines Grow?
Sure.
Tell listeners a little bit about what the organisation does.
Sure. Well, I'm sure your listeners will be familiar with the late Kevin Hines. So Kevin Hines Grow is the garden centre that Kevin set up in Doncaster. We're almost 40 years old now. It's been a little while, longer than I've been around. And the organisation does some absolutely fantastic work. So we have a community garden, which is there with the purpose of bringing gardening and horticultural-based therapy to people of all abilities. So we work with children, young people, adults, families, refugees, migrants, people with mental health concerns, people with all kinds of disabilities, people on the autism spectrum, to get them involved in nature, to provide an opportunity for them to engage with the natural world and with gardening. And it's also a great melting pot, I suppose, of a whole range of people on a daily and weekly basis. So it's a fantastic place to work.
How do people get to hear about the program and actually get involved? Do they have to be referred? Do they just turn up because they've heard about it from someone else?
Sure. So a range of ways. We get a lot of official referrals, so from places like hospitals or special schools, as the others have mentioned some of those places already. But people can self-refer. People can, you know, wander past the garden one day and think, oh, that looks like a nice place, and come in for a chat. So we get all kinds. We've had people who've been attending the garden in one capacity or another for close to those 40 years.
Okay.
And people who will come in each and every week, new people to experience the garden. So it's a real variety.
There was talk at one stage that the Kevin Hines Garden Centre was going to have to relocate. Has that now been shelved, or what's happened there?
Look, we're constantly kind of under that rain cloud, I suppose.
Okay.
Because we don't own our own property. So while we've been at our current facility for a very, very long time, there's a very real possibility that within the next several years we will have to move. That we've thought that before. We might think that again.
Yeah, okay.
But there's a very real possibility we'll be calling on the community for assistance with that, because as you can imagine, moving a garden and a space of that size is not an easy proposition. And there's a range of requirements. As you know, obviously it needs to be fully accessible to people with you know, physical disabilities and various needs as well. So it's not just a case of, you know, pointing at a site and that's it. There's a lot of requirements and planning that goes into that.
Yes. Oh, well, good luck with all of that.
Yes, challenges ahead, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely, yes. Absolutely. Stephen, if I can get back to you, because you work very closely, particularly as a hort therapist. And because of your travels overseas, what is the actual some of the research that's been done as to why horticultural therapy works and works across such a broad range of disabilities?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting topic, because trying to do research within this field is not an easy task, and often the research is out there and talking about it from a physiological point of view, connecting with people and plants, but also in an emotional and a psychological advantage as well, and benefit.
Mm-hmm.
I know for myself, working with people who are, have an illness or are recovering from an injury, for example, the context of the garden is actually quite a powerful experience for many.
Yes.
And it's an interesting thing to try and describe. So there is research, but there's also the aspect of the lived experience, watching and observing how people, their connection with being within nature, within a garden space, has an impact, but also the act of doing it. For many, I know myself working with people that have anxiety, stress, uncertainty about what life will be following an illness or an injury, that actual chance to reconnect and spend time and giving themselves that opportunity to go, I can still do things. I will still be able to do things. Like most of the people that I work with in the horticultural therapy program are gardeners. That's their interest, their passion. For some, it's even their vocation. So the chance for them to reconnect with it during that time has some quite profound benefits. And for those that aren't even gardeners, the aspect is that they get this renewed interest and the benefit of going, I can still do things. I will be able to do things. Hey, this is something new that I'm wanting to explore. And for some, it may actually be a new passion or even a career direction. Just hearing the lady speak before in the previous section, that whole, there's a whole time of renewal and change and having to rethink what the future is for people. So gardening and horticulture are fantastic opportunities with that.
Mm. Now, you work with clients with a wide range of different disabilities. I know you work with acquired brain injury clients, but you also work with people like stroke victims, a huge range.
Yeah, certainly. So people that have had spinal cord injuries,
yes.
Have had neurological issues. For some of that, they've had a stroke. For others, it might be people that have had a brain hemorrhage or issues with hypoxia, which is a lack of oxygen to the brain. And then also those with an acquired brain injury. So those that have had something not from birth.
Mm-hmm.
That's essentially the definition. So a trauma. Unfortunately, it's a bit of a topical at the moment because I heard just the other day with this rain that we've been having.
Yes.
High incidence of people falling off ladders. Which is, you know, that aspect, and which reminds us that people that I look after in that context are everyday normal people with things that have unfortunately happened to them, and therefore their life has changed. So quite a diversity of people and circumstances.
Mm. Well, of course, it's not just maybe the reconnection with being in the garden, if they were gardeners in the first place, but just the fact that they are outside in the fresh air, I mean, the sun might be shining or they might feel the rain on their face, it makes them come alive again, doesn't it? It makes you feel you're really part of the environment.
Absolutely. As Basil mentioned, you know, that experience I've seen similarly with people that have come out from the clinical environment, the ward environment. Many, many haven't been out of the ward for weeks or months, but just that opportunity to come outside, reconnect, and not feel like, well, to reconnect with the natural environment and the feel the fresh air on their face and not the air-conditioned temperature, for example. But that many of them, you know, that's quite a positive cathartic experience to be able to get outside and not have that I am defined by my circumstance or injury situation, where the conversations are often when people are inside.
Yes, yes. Basil, to get back to you, Croxton have had a very extensive program of gardening with the students there at the school. Can you tell listeners a little bit more about the program that takes place at Croxton?
At Croxton, Pam, I guess to start off, every school is different and every school has a different strengths and challenges and staffing support and dollars behind their programs. And really, I would encourage every school, whether you're a big school or a small school, to just go for it and do the best that you can with what you have.
Mm-hmm.
At Croxton, we have I work there 3 days a week. One day is delivering the certificate to VCOL Hort program, which includes students from Hume Valley Special and Ascot Vale Special. So those students are very involved with myself and other staff members in undertaking the Cert 2 modules of the Cert 2 Hort program.
So they will actually come through that program with a certificate, with a qualification with, in horticulture?
If they haven't got the whole certificate, they'll have modules going towards that certificate.
Yes.
For some of the students who are the shining role models, like my friend Chris over here, they will have the opportunity to gain meaningful employment in the broader community in a gardening program. Mm. For other kids, it will simply be taking those recreational skills to wherever they're living, whether it be at home or in a community-based setting. But apart from that, with the program that we deliver at Croxton is for the youngest children through to the 18-year-old students. And as a result, we've created a very, very beautiful garden environment around the school. And the students play a very, very active and a very important role in maintaining the school gardens. And it's very exciting at the moment, Pam. I took the kids for a walk this week and we were jumping out of our skin with excitement because our pumpkin seedlings have gone nuts in the last few weeks.
Right.
So we're actually hoping to have a bumper crop of pumpkins next year. But we've got a massive composting program. We take a lot of the green waste from Ceres, from their organic food veggie co-op, and we've got a colossal composting project. So all of that compost goes into the garden, and we probably have planted out about 50 pumpkin plants in the last month, and they're starting to take over the school. So, and it's exciting sharing that with the kids.
Oh, absolutely. You have a very open policy at the school, don't you? So the community is invited in at any time.
And that's one of the very, very special components of the Croxton project, Pam, is that we have a community kitchen garden, and our garden we have allocated certain plots for members from the local community. So we have four plots for local families or local households, and they all sign an agreement, an understanding of being involved in that school garden out of school hours. So they have a key to the garden. They have the benefit of collecting the eggs on the weekend or in the school holidays from our very happy chickens, who are very, very well fed. When things are dry, they'll water the fruit trees and the veggies. And in the summer months, I say, please harvest and take whatever you can, because I hate to see any of the produce falling on the ground and being wasted.
Yeah. Yes.
So I think that is a really, really positive aspect of the program that I hope more and more schools can nurture, because we have this land which can be enjoyed by the broader community, but the benefits come back to the school as well. Mm. Because inevitably, come holidays, people say, who's going to look after the garden? Who's going to water the fruit trees? Who's going to collect the eggs and feed the chickens and so on? So, it's taken... I've been at Croxton for 10 years and I think it's a great model.
Mm, fantastic. Well, we have to say a very good morning to your friend here, Chris Hansen. Chris, thanks for coming into the studio.
That's okay.
Now, you were a student at Croxton.
Yes.
So you worked with Basil in the garden.
Yes, I did.
Okay. And did you also do the VCAL program?
No, I didn't.
Okay. You just worked in the garden as a basic garden program.
Yeah.
Okay, and you're now working in the western suburbs, and actually with a gardening crew.
Yes.
Tell us what that involves. What do you do?
I used to work in the garden. Now I'm just doing part-time. I'm at the factory full-time.
Right.
And their garden crew have a contract with Central Lakes Gardens Inc. So it's like a retirement village where they do the gardens there.
Okay.
Pulling out weeds and planting stuff.
Right. So does that also involve things like mowing the lawns?
They have their own people do that.
Okay. So just maintaining the garden beds.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wonderful. And do you enjoy doing that?
Yes, I do.
How many others would work with you in those gardens?
It's just two people from the factory, myself and one of my other friends.
Okay. So is there a lot of work to do then?
Yes,
I bet.
Is.
Yes. And how often would you get to go into the garden?
When they need us, it'd be a Monday and a Wednesday or Monday and Friday.
Okay. So they phone where you work
and
say that they need you to come along.
Yeah.
Yes. Terrific. What do you do apart from the gardening?
I pack show bags, do brackets and do a show post.
Okay. And you enjoy the work?
Yeah.
That's excellent. Good. All right. Basil, this is wonderful, isn't it? I know you've worked with Stephen in the past with a a group of students from Croxton that actually were doing maintenance out at Royal Talbot.
Well, in fact, Pam, Chris was one of those young guys.
Oh, right.
Because this has been an ongoing program at Royal Talbot, the rehab centre, and sometimes a project runs away from us a little bit. The mm-hmm. weeds have gone nuts in recent months. But it's such an important project because it's given our students a very, very real opportunity to get down on their hands and knees and to weed and pull out. And sometimes they pull out plants as well as the weeds. But do you know what? We don't really care. We're just happy that the kids are engaged and get their hands dirty.
And how does this tie in with the clients you have that are out there?
It's fantastic. One of the things there's many things I love about how this works. So it's been nearly, I think it's about 7 years now. The great thing is that I see it for us at Austin Health that it's twofold. It's great for our patients. We get the benefit of seeing the garden being worked on, developed, activity happening out. This garden is immediately outside the spinal rehab ward.
Okay.
So the patients' beds look onto it.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other side, it's a courtyard area. And the other side is their therapy gym, occupational therapy, physio gym. And so the people that are in there, the patients, their families, the staff, they see the students coming in, all the activity of that happening, seeing the changes that happen with that. But also for us, it's great to a great relationship with Croxton School because they're coming into our site. The students are having the opportunity to work horticulturally, but also to go, oh, there's other people here in different situations. We're helping other people. We're part of the bigger picture. So from my point of view, there's some really fantastic benefits that come out of this. A little while back, one of our nurse unit managers from the ward was saying, The structure of that ward is that this garden where they work on predominantly is on one side, and they actually have people requesting to move when a bed comes empty up on that side of the ward, looking out over the garden, because that's what they enjoy most seeing.
Right.
Rather than the other side that's just, it's nice, it's green, it's got lawn and some distant trees, but they love the aspect of being on that spot there.
Mind you, Steve, there are times when some of our students use more than colourful language when they're working in the garden, and we say, look, we want you to have fun and enjoy yourselves, but just keep the volume down a little bit. But Pam, I just wanted to say that Chris's mum, I bumped into Chris and his mum on the train several years ago, and she told me how exciting it was that Chris had developed this work ethic through, and that's what we've really pushed, is making the young people work physically hard and to get a sense of what's required of them. But she told me how much Chris enjoyed getting up in the morning and going off to work. And Chris, what about, tell Pam about what the gear that you wear. When you were working in the garden crew, what did you have to wear?
We had to wear high-vis, like wear a T-shirt and have a high-vis vest over top.
Right.
Because we're working on the roads.
Oh, yes. So you need to be visible.
Yeah.
Yes. That's an excellent thing for your safety.
Yeah, and I had to wear my steel cut boots.
Ah, right. Very essential for working in the garden.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. And do you enjoy, you enjoyed going to Royal Talbot and working out there?
Yes, I did.
Did you get to meet many of the patients?
Or
they were mainly
in the,
but
the
looking out through the windows, watching what you were up to.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
And I think not that Chris was in this situation, but what Basil mentioned about the others, the realness of just seeing conversations happen, and yes, there might have been colourful language, but it was just fantastic because it was the, it was everyday normal activity. And the benefit of it was that, from our point of view, the gardens were worked on, were improved, but there was the thing that I also enjoyed and have seen shared with that was over the course of the year, people could see the difference because obviously some of our patients in that context are there for many months.
Yes, of course.
And that's equally as important for them to see things happening, people coming into the space, enjoyment happening within that context as well.
Mm.
And also, Steve, the other through our connection with Steve is that the students from Croxton now work on a regular basis at the Austin Hospital School.
Yes.
Right. So we help to develop that garden and we maintain it. So we go in a couple of times in the term and the students play a very important role in developing that garden as well, Steve. Mm.
Absolutely, and that's been really exciting to see because we've been able to change that garden structurally a little bit as well. But the relationship of, for me, seeing the students and the Croxton team come in, and that aspect again of longevity and seeing the gardens change over the course of the year and grow, and particularly when you're developing some spaces, and the relationships that we have with the staff and the students in the school collectively is just brilliant.
Pam, I'll just say quickly, last week we had great joy in taking a group of students from Croxton to Government House, and we had morning tea with the Governor and, and her husband and in the garden at Government House. But the kids were involved in making scarecrows, and so we made a very beautiful scarecrow wearing overalls and wearing a fluoro top, Chris, and steel cap boots, and we took him to Government House, and he's going to be one of an army of scarecrows that will be made by children from special schools in Victoria to bring life into the kitchen garden at Government House.
Fantastic. What a wonderful opportunity.
It was very, very, very exciting. And I wrote to the staff at Government House after the event because they put out the red carpet in a way that I'll never, ever forget. I had visions that there might be hundreds of children coming along to this event, but in fact there were a small group of students from Croxton and a small group of students from Diamond Valley Special School. And that was it.
Right.
And we were there, and we were the very special guests of the Governor and her husband, and the staff put out the red carpet, gave the children morning tea, took photos with the Governor and her husband, and then we went on a tour through Government House, and it was just an incredibly exciting event where every student was made to feel so important and so valued, but they have all contributed in a very colourful and an exciting way to the ongoing development of the kitchen garden, garden at Government House.
Well, you are listening to the 3CR Gardening Show. We are running a very special program this morning to celebrate International Day for People with Disabilities. If you'd like to join in the conversation, if you are disabled yourself and you enjoy gardening, or if you've had some experience of working perhaps in one of these gardening environments, if you're a nurse, if you're working in some sort of community facility with people with disabilities and you'd like to contribute to the discussion, do give us a call. That number is 94190155. That's 94190155. We'd love to hear from you this morning if you'd like to join in this conversation. Josh, if I can get back to you, at Kevin Hines Grow, do you run any specialised programs, or is it just that the garden is there and provided for people to come in when they want to? How does it work?
Yeah, look, it's a mix of both. We have a range of targeted programs. So similar to some of the work that we've been talking about already this morning, we have programs for secondary school students transitioning from secondary school with a disability. So that they might be looking at what comes after school, whether they do want to train for an employment setting, or whether they're looking for a service that they can engage with after school. We work a lot with young people all right throughout their 20s as well, who might have an intellectual disability and might be at various stages of developing their life skills, individual living skills, employment training. Everyone has a unique set of goals and aspirations. And so we develop programs for working with those young people. So we have sort of a core group that's in, day out at Kevin Hines, and we'll work with them on their particular goals. One of our young people just got his license last week, his full driver's license, after several years of training, which was absolutely fantastic. So it's all down to what individual goals are. So it's not even just about the garden. It's about using the garden and horticulture as a means for working together and developing those skills. And I think that's what's really important. It's the medium. It's not necessarily the end for all the young people we work with. But a range range of other programs as well. As I mentioned, you know, we work with groups of seniors who have English as a second language, and we bring them together in the garden to you know, learn about gardening in an Australian environment, in Australian climate, and that's a great social aspect for them as well. People who might otherwise be quite socially isolated. We have people who will come in and have individual programs designed for them who may have an acquired brain injury, for example, and, you know, readjusting to a life that's a little bit different to what they knew before, and using that space and therapeutic environment to help them manage that transition and get back out of the house and get back involved with nature and the community. So there's a range of things that we offer, as well as just the ability for people to drop into the garden.
Mm. Now, you mentioned in the... Hopefully, way off in the future, you may have to relocate. Perhaps you could tell listeners some of the physical requirements, like if you did have to relocate the whole garden, some of the physical requirements that are needed for a garden setting for people with disabilities. I mean, obviously, wheelchair access is very important, so paths have to be a certain width for wheelchairs to access it easily. Yep. Things like the height of garden beds.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, we've made all those sorts of adjustments to our current site over the years. In terms of moving, you know, it may be a relatively greenfield site that we have to transform again, and that's fine. But those sorts of things are absolutely necessary. As you mentioned, raised garden beds, really important for all sorts of people. You know, we also have a lot of school groups that come through primary schools and so on. So you've got to have the ability to get right down there in the dirt, and then the ability to have those raised garden beds and pots and wheelchair accessible paths so that everyone can participate.
It's a lot to think about, isn't it?
It is a lot to think about. We have a really sort of vast breadth of people coming through the garden, and we have to be able to cater to everyone, and that has to be done in an environment which is safe and welcoming. So there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of design aspects to consider. Where we are at the moment is really developed organically over the years. So I suppose one aspect of having that fresh start of moving somewhere else is we'll be able to design that therapeutic environment from scratch.
Yes.
So, you know, you've got to look at the silver linings of these
things.
Which
could be a real positive for you.
It could be,
yes.
Yeah,
yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, and we know, we probably know a lot more about... you know, the evidence base of you know, using nature and designing therapeutic environments that we did 40 years ago. People have always known about the health and well-being benefits of nature, I suppose, and being in nature. But in terms of how that academic discipline has developed over those decades, I think we've certainly got a lot more to back what we might want to do now than previously.
Excellent.
Pam, can we talk about volunteers, those incredible people who make these projects possible?
Absolutely.
I just wanted to float that V word, because I look at every garden project that I look at or that I've been involved with, I think has really only been able to go to that next level because of the extraordinary support of volunteers. And I look at Croxton. I've got a couple of volunteers at Croxton, a volunteer at Springvale Park. I know Steve probably has some volunteers who help at the Austin as well. But I just think that these people are extraordinary characters, and I know that it's a two-way deal. They love to help in the garden, but also they go away at the end of the day with something extra special, having contributed to a project for kids or people with complex needs.
I think just sharing the communication between different groups of people is very enriching for both sides.
Yeah, and absolutely, Pam. Look, at Croxton, for example, I've got a retired scientist, engineer, and I've also got the local lollipop man. And do you know what? The garden is a common meeting place.
Yes.
And I have Rod and Danny who come and work with me in the garden, and who both have so much to offer to the students at Croxton. And I just put these guys up on a pedestal, because we couldn't do what we're doing without those extra pairs of hands.
I think, Josh, from your point of view with Kevin Hines Grow, I mean, that's my understanding, is that that's the almost, yes, there's the paid staff that you have, but the lifeblood is the amount of volunteers. I'm always impressed by the amount that you guys work with and the roles that they all have.
Yeah, and look, you're exactly right. The whole organisation wouldn't exist without volunteers, and was volunteer run for many a year, as are lots of not-for-profits at the start of their life. But we do have a really vibrant volunteer program. We have volunteers come in every day of the week, as you were mentioning, Basil, you've got some incredible people there. I mean, we have doctors and nurses and social workers and psychologists and, people who are coming in and contributing their expertise and experience. And we also have many people with disabilities come in and volunteer. And so it's a real breadth, I suppose. We welcome anyone who wants to make a contribution, and there's certainly a role for everyone, whether that's working in the garden or helping with program design or fundraising or all those sorts of things. Yeah,
and I think that's the strength of volunteerism, is that there is a diversity. Mm. We all bring different gifts, abilities, skills, knowledge, vocations, and it's a wonderful melting pot, but at the end of the day, there's a commonality of the garden context for the environments we work in, and that's actually what brings people together.
Yeah.
Yes, those skills that people have can add more to what we're doing, but by the same token, that fantastic aspect of gardening being that melting pot, everyone coming in and everyone, that's the commonality, and we're all just... Doesn't matter who you are, what you are, how you come to do it, that we're all equals in that context.
Mm, absolutely. Well, we've had a caller ring in. We're going to go to Rebecca, who's in Richmond. Good morning, Rebecca.
Hello. I'm enjoying the program. Thank you.
Good.
Look, I've been blind all my life, and totally blind, that is, and I've always had a lovely garden. But now I've got physical problems, and I'd like to be working in my garden, but I'd like assistance to make it more accessible for me to work in. So I don't know what can be suggested or offered.
Josh, do you have anyone that actually goes out and gives assistance to people in their own homes?
We were running a program for a while where we were matching volunteers with people in these sorts of situations who needed a bit of extra assistance in getting their gardens up and going. That's not running at the moment due to the ever-present funding issues looming. You do need, you need staff and people to help coordinate volunteers like this, but we'd be very happy to take a call and take some details and see if we can assist in any way. It's always good to know that the need is out there, because that helps us show the need, I suppose, for funding and to take that to people. So we'd be very happy to have a chat.
Okay, so how would Rebecca contact you?
She can give us a call during the week at the Garden Centre, which is the number is 9848 3695.
9848 3695.
That's right. We'd be happy to have a chat.
Did you get that, Rebecca?
Thank you very much. 9848 3695,
That's it. And that's Kevin Hines Grow.
Yes, I better braille it straight away.
Okay.
Thank you so much. I just need help to make it accessible. I won't need ongoing help. But,
no.
You know.
It sounds like the ideal match for Kevin Hines Grow. So
we'll see what we can do, Rebecca, or we can probably point you in the right direction if we can't help ourselves.
All right.
Wonderful. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Righto. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That number, if you'd like to join in the conversation this morning, we are discussing and celebrating International Day of People with Disabilities, and in particular in regard to gardening and horticulture. If you'd like to join in with us, the number is 9419 0155. Chris, tell me, do you have a garden at home?
No, I don't.
You don't? Oh, that's not good.
What about your mum, Chris?
My mum's not really a gardener.
Right.
So her friends die.
What about starting off a few pot plants?
Yeah, I could do that.
I think that would be great. You could grow some edible vegetables in pot plants, and I'm sure Mum would be grateful for those too.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think your mum's listening in, and she's probably shaking her head and saying, Chris, as soon as we go home, we've got to do some gardening.
I'm wonderful. Stephen, I noticed that that the Wellness Centre with Olivia Newton-John's centre is actually now incorporating a horticultural program.
Yeah, so we started that just over earlier this year, I think. Last year. And it's funded through fundraising and donations. And it's a program where people can come in, connect with the garden spaces, but also with Sue, who's the horticultural therapist there, and engage with her during that session time. She runs a session that will connect with people from predominantly the outpatients area.
Okay.
Fantastic nature engagement activities. Sometimes it's potting up and doing things. Sometimes it's working with plants, craft activities that relate work in and around with plants. So it's been fantastic to see that start and continue because when the building was done, they did incorporate a large central courtyard, and that's a nice space that people from that facility go and spend time in. But actually there's quite a few staff that venture from other areas of the hospital because it's such a nice spot to go to. I vividly remind myself of the situation when the building was first built and I had the chance to put some personalised elements within the garden, as I like to say. You know, the garden was done and it was very structural.
Yes.
From the building process, but the opportunity to bring in places for people to sit, some interesting pots and plants. And the comment that I had from one of the staff members was that many aspects, she said she was quite excited. She sent me an email saying, it's so good to see people in the garden space from the wards. There was, was a staff member on a break, but there was a mum that was there with her young child waiting for an appointment, and there was someone down in there in the garden in her PJs, but with her IV pole with medication going through. So even with that, they took the opportunity to go down off the ward and into that garden space. So the garden's there, but also the horticultural therapy program that Sue now runs is another opportunity for people to connect and engage.
Mm.
It's a challenging environment in many respects for people, but that opportunity to get off of the ward and spend time just having some respite in that space and connecting with the garden program has been just fantastic.
Mm. Well, I mean, just being hospitalised is such a traumatic experience, and even if you're coming in as an outpatient, you're full of anxieties, obviously, with your own ill health, and to be able to just sit in the garden, if it's only for 10, 15 minutes, and just unwind take a deep breath and reconnect with nature, as you said.
It was, absolutely. And I feel quite fortunate when I'm have the chance to share about the gardens out in the community. It's quite exciting to hear people's responses back. And I had one recently where a lady had said she was bringing her friend to our Repat campus for an outpatient appointment. And her friend was quite anxious because of the news and the context of her situation and what she was about to have to deal with. And they came across the labyrinth that we'd built a few years ago now, and it's an amazing quiet little space for her for contemplation and meditation. And she said that when they found it, took a friend in there, and they just travelled, walked around the loop of the labyrinth. And she said it was quite amazing to see the difference for her friend, and it had calmed her, it had centered her a little bit in the sense of just she wasn't as anxious about heading into this appointment. So having opportunities within hospitals, how big or small they are, I think are quite important. And it can often be seen as that little bit of just that's a bit of greenery, that's just nice. But I think the importance is us sharing and communicating the layers behind it, what it means for people.
Absolutely. Well, we'll go to our next caller, and we have Sally, who's in South Frankston. Good morning, Sally.
Good morning. I was, I've been mostly interested in the evolutionary side of our love of nature and gardening. I'm disabled now, but my dearest wish would be to be up in Mataranka in the bush on my own, just walking through beside this gorgeous little river. You keep well enough away from the edge in case there should be crocodiles. But the bush was just so open and gentle and friendly. And another 20 metres further in from the river, I could see a dingo trotting along beside me.
Right.
And when I later on we had some young people who were in danger or in trouble with drugs and that sort of thing, who were tenants in my father's place, and I got them together in a group and we went gardening. We just advertised and, my God, it really helped. It saved some of them from what would have been very nasty consequences of their associations. And I have always been a keen gardener. Now I can't, but I can. I've got friends who have helped me set up a garden around my unit in a retirement village. And what I'd live for is seeing the beautiful flowers come out. Every morning I go to my, I've got a long stretch of windows and I can walk up and down the garden and see everything and watch what new thing is coming out or what one is in danger and needs help. And Lunig, the cartoonist, I'm quite sure he was very bipolar. And for that bipolar people, the bush is an absolute need, a refuge for the soul. And the same for just about all of us. You know, how we always trot off to some remote place.
Yeah.
Honestly, it would be just wonderful if we could live like the Aborigines, the way they evolved to do things, and yet have access to the wonderful comforts of modern life. But I see where we're heading and I don't think it's very nice. And I really think we should pay more attention to the Aborigines because they did actually have types of agriculture and they had ways of, they'd have great big feasts once a year and all the tribes would come together and their fish traps were organised to have the most select fish there for the picking at the time of the conference. And they would form a big semicircle and drive all the kangaroos in it into a V-shaped thing they've created and pick the ones they wanted for their feast and let the mothers and babies go. And they also cultivated their own grain. They had one particular one. And I've looked around in outback Australia and I never saw anything that I thought could be cultivated.
Mm.
But I just have this, now that I'm not able to do any of this, I see just how important it is for disabled people to be able to reconnect with our natural heritage.
Absolutely.
And, anyway, what do you have to say about this?
No, well, totally. And the other thing that there's a big push on at the moment is to try to provide many more access to parks, to greening up our cities, to planting trees. Not only does that give us the benefit of cooling down our cities, but it means that people are given the opportunity to connect with nature, even if it's just walking down a main street, but they can hug a tree along the way and feel the shade of the tree and hear the birds. And this is so essential to our living. We overdeveloped. We created concrete jungles, and I think bringing the garden, the greenery back into all of our lives is essential for all of our well-being.
Yes, trees are one of the best, and the other thing is planting your own veggies and crops. And I just the other day had a first of my berry shrubs. I found some little berries ripening in the depths of it, so I had my first bit of self-produced food.
Wonderful. It's a very exciting thing to do, and that's why I love the spread of community gardens too, round not only around Melbourne, but it's growing right around Australia, and that gives people who don't have land around their home or access that they can suddenly do their own gardening and grow their own produce.
Yes, I'm delighted by this development. Mm. I'm even delighted to see my own town of Frankston so much greener than it was 30 or 40 years ago.
Excellent.
And it just makes you feel relaxed.
Good.
I think in future years, Sally, being a teacher and working in school settings, we will see more and more schools opening up their grounds to the broader community, because often schools do have a big chunk of land.
Yes,
and
yes.
And often people who live nearby may live in an apartment or a tower of some sort, or may not have a big backyard. So to have access to a garden in land which is used between 9 to 3 and then at the end of the day the kids go home is a wonderful way for the community to benefit from the development of those school gardens.
And the company they have with other people who feel the same.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call, Sally. Bye.
Bye.
As I mentioned, if you'd like to be a part of the conversation this morning, we are running a very special program to celebrate International Day of People with Disabilities, and in particular in regards to gardening and horticulture. If you'd like to join us, the number is 9419 0155. That's 9419 0155. Stephen, let's talk a little bit about you got your Churchill Scholarship. You travelled overseas specifically to look at what was happening overseas in terms of horticultural therapy and some of the centres being provided, the facilities. Are they much ahead of us? Are they doing anything exciting? What's going on overseas?
Yeah, certainly. So to clarify, one of the things I was interested to look at was being within the healthcare context myself, was to look at some of the processes that people have put in place to manage, develop and maintain therapeutic gardens within healthcare settings.
Okay.
So not specifically the horticultural therapy programs.
Right.
People had travelled with that with the trust before, so I wanted to do something a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
But it was quite interesting to see that those the healthcare facilities that incorporated a horticultural therapy program as part of those gardens certainly had a greater use and engagement of those garden spaces and awareness of how they get used. And that was one of the interesting things, because often for me, I hear and talk to a lot of people that want to develop a garden, and often there's a little bit of the romance of that. Wouldn't it be wonderful? Oh, it'd be fantastic. Oh, you mean we have to maintain it? Oh, you mean do we have to fund it beyond the installation?
Yes.
So for me, that was one of the drivers of going, right, where are the people that are doing this well, and what are the things they've put in place? And one of those things is significantly about collaboration, collaborating with people from all levels of the spectrum, from management to those that are allied health professionals, through to those that will be maintaining the garden space.
Mm-hmm.
And having where that model worked well, that's where the gardens in these healthcare settings were the successful ones. Because often people, you know, the fundraising department and or the management and maintenance staff are the ones that, particularly the maintenance and management staff, are often the ones that are forgotten. And they're the ones that are left at the end and gone, here's your project, or here's the garden, you've got to now look after it.
Yes.
Whereas having them involved in the initial stages, having the allied health professionals involved to know how the garden will be used, who's going to use it, what are the aspects that need to be incorporated physically, but also plant selection, so that they are quite that they are moving beyond just that romance of putting it in. And a significant amount of money often goes into it, and often that's donated money, or pretty much most of the time it is. Occasionally it might be grant funds, but it's then about having good due diligence of use of that fund, because people have given from, you know, their own pockets for that to happen.
That's right.
So you really, for me, it's really important to make that work well and to learn from those that have done that. So out of interest, one of the things I came across was for larger scale gardens, which are projects, but can also be for smaller scale projects within healthcare facilities and transferable elsewhere, that it wasn't just the funds that they were, that it would cost to develop it that were sought, but they incorporated a maintenance endowment where it meant, we know this is going to be long-term. This is not just a in and done. So rather than plucking a figure out of my head, rather than it costing $50,000 to build, it was $50,000 plus a maintenance component for X amount of years. Once those funds were sought, then the project went ahead, because they understood and management understood that this is something that we want to keep presenting well, achieving the goals of setting up a garden. Often say that, you know, because there's often that impetus to develop a garden, but then the disconnect of what will it look like afterwards, often they do decline. They fall into disrepair.
Yes.
And that kind of goes against what you're actually wanting to achieve. You're wanting to create spaces and garden programs that integrate well, but you don't want it to fall off and die, because those that are looking from inside are going, wow, I feel not the best, and now I'm looking out onto a dead garden, and I don't feel the best. That doesn't make me feel any better.
No, exactly.
So some of those things are quite important to get in place, or to have on the discussion right from the beginning, and that's at all levels, so from management's point of view, from the allied health staff point of view, and the maintenance.
Can you see the benefit of involving more schools like Croxton in these gardens, in the maintenance side of them?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, this has been a great relationship with Austin Health and Croxton School. As I said, touching on what Josh was talking about, garden in itself is the medium with which a lot of the other things happen. So yes, the benefit of getting a garden up and running is great. That takes effort and maintenance to maintain that, but there's far better benefits that come from it. For Chris and his other friends and the students at the school, it's a great activity for them to be involved in. They're seeing the benefit that it provides for other people, and it's not just about the tasks they're doing, but the relationship between us, between the school and the hospital, that's a fantastic relationship and benefit from that as well. So yeah, certainly, you know, it's certainly something that I'd think would be a great for anyone out there that's listening and thinking, pursue that thought, because yes, there are opportunities that can bring about some fantastic outcomes.
I think though that that's exactly right what you're saying about the need to sort of factor in maintenance and that ongoing relationship you've got with the garden once it's there. We do a lot of consultancy at Kevin Hines Grow with our consultancy arm Humanscape, and what we often find is people sort of expect that they'll give us a call and they'll say, well, you know, come put in a therapy garden, and it's not quite how it works. Correct. We don't just sort of pick it up from a box and plonk it there and then it looks after itself forever. It's about that developing that whole understanding of what that relationship's going to be with that space from design right through to use over the years. It's an asset that needs to be maintained and loved. Correct. And looked after like any other asset. So if you're a hospital or a school, you've got to think about it. How would you maintain your equipment? How do you look after your staff? And how do you look after your therapy garden? It's just the same sort of thing.
Yes.
I love that, because often in a few other different situations, always try and bring the example back to what's happening inside, because everyone has an understanding of what's happening inside. You know, there's equipment, there's furniture, there's staff, there's things that need to be maintained, and there's budgets for that. But there's a disconnect with what's happened outside, and it's like, oh, that's just what happens outside.
Yeah, nature will look after itself.
Yeah.
Sort of
And it's like, no, you know, one aspect was a safety aspect in one discussion with a garden project, and, you know, there were rocks, and oh my goodness, what might happen when the kids play on rocks? And it's like, so how do we view that, like the corner of the cabinet inside in the playroom?
Hmm.
Do we value them equally or judge them equally? But there's almost this, there's rocks. Yeah. That's unsafe. And you go, well, there's an edge on that that's just the same as inside.
So, yeah. A child can climb on a desk just like they can climb on some rocks.
I know.
Of
course. Yeah. I know. Yeah. So it's fantastic to have that knowledge and that awareness of people going, oh, yeah, get it now.
Mm.
It needs to be, there is more than just the in and it's done.
Yes. With Humanscapes, how do you have a collaboration with a maintenance crew, or how do you manage that?
So our team at Humanscape will work with people on site. So whoever the client is at the time, it could be a small hospital, for example, or a hospice. We make it very clear that it's not just a case of plonking a garden in there. That there needs to be consideration to how that will be maintained over time. Obviously, that becomes the responsibility of whatever organisation it is we're working with. But we try and instil that understanding and work with them to come up with a plan of how the space will be used and who will be involved as much as possible to try and get them off on the right setting.
It's essential, isn't it?
Absolutely yeah. Is. And I think, that's part of the design and development of the concept from day one is how will the space be used? Who's going to interact with the space? And that includes, who owns the space in terms of that maintenance and growth and ongoing work.
Mm. Mm. I'm delighted to say that through this program, I'm often have people in who are garden designers specifically for school gardens or for gardens at preschools. And more nature play is coming into it. There's plenty of rocks. There's plenty of trees to climb. This whole concept of keeping children wrapped up in cotton wool is being blown apart, thank goodness.
It's nice to see the pendulum swing back a little bit.
It is.
But it's interesting because the department, from my understanding, it's their decree of wanting to incorporate these sort of these environments for development, an appropriate development for children. That's fantastic. But it's that fine balance too of also making sure that those that are in that space, the staff, and work with the risks with that. And also that because we're all sometimes we all vary on our own individual risk processes. And for a parent going into that environment, that's also a bit of a challenge too of how they view leaving their loved child in an environment where there's potential risks.
Yes.
But that's, calculated. These are designed gardens with knowledge about how to do that well.
That's right. And it comes back to education.
It does. So it's an interesting environment, but I'm so excited to see and feel there's a pendulum swing.
Oh, it definitely is. Yes.
Because we do need it. The era of putting concrete everywhere because that's safe.
That's right.
Is hopefully going.
Pam, I think you may be aware, VSGA, Victorian School Garden Awards, have run a series of professional development days over the year for teachers and volunteers and people interested in the development of school garden programs. And over this year, some of the gardens that we've featured in those professional development days have been gardens in which natural materials like locks, boulders and little creek beds and water gardens have become a feature.
Mm.
And you may have met Richard Bellemo, I think, in the past.
Yes.
So a lot of Richard's work is focusing on school gardens, but with an incredible emphasis on looking at the whole school picture. Richard brings a conservation land management view of the project. So rather than just plonking in a garden using logs and rocks and whatever, Richard looks at the whole school and how can we capture the water off the roof? How can we make the most of the aspect of the sun? How can we utilise that soil that we're shifting away from there? Can we make a great big mound for the kids to play on? And one of the gardens that we went to this year was at Noble Park Primary School,
okay,
where Richard has done a lot of work with the staff there. And the school has done extraordinary work in promoting the concept of children interacting with nature and nature play. And even on the wildest, windiest days, they get the kids outside playing, constructing in their bushland garden, building shelters and cubbies using natural materials.
Mm.
And I think, as you said, Steve, there is a shift that's happening, and we're seeing it happening, where people are saying, hang on, these places, these school grounds are really vital in terms of giving children a balance of experiences, not just the iPads and all that IT stuff happening inside, but a chance to actually roll and tumble and play and clamber and get their hands and their feet wet and go home at the end of the day feeling good.
Yes, excellent.
And I think, sorry, the thing that I find exciting about that too is that, you know, there's so much within the natural environment. I often find myself being caught in stopping in the moment with, like the other day I had a little beetle, brightly coloured blue, green beetle land on me just by sitting in the garden, and I'm sitting there going, wow. Like, you're just in awe of that. So for the children to be exposed with the, you know, there's skinks and there's beetles and there's, you know, all those aspects in the garden, that taps into that fascination and wonder and development of, you know, the bigger world around them.
Mm. But they're also learning things like sustainability.
Correct.
You know, environmental issues. I mean, what happens with wastewater runoff, for instance? You know, how can we collect it and not lose that off the property? So they're learning so much from delving into these things.
And I think if it's the same school that I'm thinking of, is the, you mentioned, Basil, the one that has the big 100-metre-long rock creek bed. I had the chance of seeing it a little while back by chance through a conversation with one of the staff members there. And he said, it's amazing to see, you know, there's this, you know, rock creek bed that's deliberately been put in, and it's people could go, oh my goodness, there's this big rock and all these rocks for kids to potentially hurt themselves on. But he said the kids love it.
Mm.
When they put the poles in as part of the feature of it, he said, before they knew it, the kids were trying to climb to the top and stand on top of the pole, and just because that's that adventure play and that discovery and, you know, testing their limits and seeing what they can do and enjoying that.
And I think it takes us back to you know, the projects in Europe and Scandinavia, I think, where there's a lot of emphasis on forest schools. You know, schools where, you know, in Finland, are you familiar with this, Steve? Where, you know, even in the depths of winter, the kids have to put on their boots and jackets and they go out and they play in the snow and they have adventures. And you know, here we get a wet weather day and people say, oh, my God, it's, you know, we have to keep everybody inside. Whereas I think really if the kids are appropriately, if we've got the appropriate boots and jackets and hats for the kids, they can go out.
Absolutely.
But at the same time, in the heat of summer, it really highlights why we need to be planting more and more shady trees in school grounds.
Of course.
So that on a really hot, stinking, you know, Victorian summer day, we know that the kids can go outside and they can sit in that forest of casuarinas and they can be protected from the sun and enjoy the fresh air at the same time.
And the other thing about creating a dry rock creek bed, it becomes a habitat haven.
Correct.
You know, you're going to get your little lizards and skinks in there, you're going to get beetles, all sorts of creatures, and the kids can discover those.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So it's a win-win, it really is. Yeah.
I think what made me think about your, following on from you, Basil, one of the horticultural therapy programs I saw in Portland in the US was at a mental health facility, and each day, regardless of the weather, they would. The part of the therapy program was to go outside. They had the appropriate clothing for them to wear. You know, in the middle of winter, it's snowing there, but they still use that as a grounding context to get people outside of the ward, go out into the garden space, and integrate with it, regardless of the weather.
Mm.
How much better does that hot chocolate taste when you've been out in the cold and the wind, and you come inside and you have morning tea, and then you can talk about what you did outside?
Correct.
Very true. We must get to a couple more callers. We have Lois, who is in Mitcham. Good morning, Lois.
Oh, good morning, Pam. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Sorry, we missed part of the program. Clock was wrong.
Oh.
anyway, my main question today to the team is books. Now, I, over the years, have collected a lot of garden books.
Mm-hmm.
They probably need culling. I was wondering whether or not the Kevin Hines Centre or somewhere like that, or do the team know of anyone that would take garden books for usage of disabled people?
That's a great offer, Lois. We actually have a couple of bookshelves full of gardening books at the Kevin Hines Garden Centre. We'd be happy to have a chat with you about what you've got and how many you've got, and we can probably take some of them off your hands. They'll be put to very good use.
Yes, well, that's the important thing, that they are put to good use.
Mm.
I was very impressed by... Sorry. I was very impressed by Shelley's conversation with you.
Right.
About the ability to get out in the garden.
Yes.
Which I'm having difficulties with. But any rate, and also the fact that the boys, I'll call them that, that people do mollycoddle children too much now. Well, I mean, people used to go out, as you say, and jump in puddles of water and climb on this and climb on that and make mud pies and pretend to eat them or eat a little bit, and they weren't any worse for wear.
Absolutely, yes.
So very good program, and if I could have a phone number, please.
Certainly, I'll give that out to you again, Lois. This is the phone number for Kevin Hines Grow.
Yes, that's
and
what I want.
Have you got paper and pencil?
I certainly have.
Okay, so it's 9848.
Yes.
3695.
9848 3695.
Yes.
And who would I speak to there,
Pat? You can speak to whoever picks up the phone. There'll be it might be me if you get the right day, so I look forward to speaking to you.
Good. And what days are the Kevin Hines gardens open?
At the moment, we're open Monday to Friday. You can come and see the garden any time between 9 a.m. and 3 p.m. Monday to Friday.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks, Lois.
Bye.
Bye. And next up we have Jill from the Herb Society. Good morning, Jill. Jill, are you there? No, we seem to have lost Jill for the moment. Okay, we've had a query, Josh, from the outside line. Please ask Josh to detail the availability of training for volunteers to assist in the program.
Yeah, certainly. So people, if they're looking to volunteer with Kevin Hines Grow, you're welcome to give us a call. We induct volunteers on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
We have an induction program and some training, and depending on what people are interested in doing, that can vary quite a bit. So if people are interested in assisting with our student program, for example, and working more closely with people with disabilities, there's obviously some different induction and training required.
Sure.
Or if people want to come and assist with different parts of the garden, you know, there's capacity for people to do that as well. But people are certainly supported. We've got a good team, a small team of staff, but a good team, and they're all very prepared to help train and support volunteers.
That's great. Fantastic. Basil, we've been talking a lot about therapy within the hospital environment, the health care facilities, also with schools. But you and I had a lot of experience with working with gardeners on the community gardens on public housing estates. And I know you can relate many, many stories of what just being able to have a garden plot in a community garden meant. Now, many of those gardeners had all a huge range of disabilities, but I think in every single case, particularly to the gardeners I spoke to, they couldn't sing the praises enough of being able to work in the garden and share their knowledge, share their time, share their conversations with other people in the gardens.
Yeah. Pam, you know very well some of the characters that, that I could be referring to in Collingwood and Fitzroy and Richmond, which is where the first community gardens, a cultivating community, is now managed. Come from, but many of these people have got very complex, you know, social, emotional, cultural, behavioural challenges. You know, which have really many have come from war-torn countries. Many have
very
experienced
trauma. Background, yes.
And I just don't think that our funding bodies recognise enough how vital it is to these people to have the opportunity to have a little piece of land where they can go every day to get their hands dirty and to create something beautiful, you know. And we're not talking about big dollars. We're talking about small dollars. When you look at the big bucket of funding that goes across to, you know, human services, I think that we need to be looking more and more on the importance of funding programs that have a hort therapy basis. Cultivating community do an extraordinary job, but one of the gardeners who I'm going to talk about now in Collingwood, his whole life was his garden plot, and he would go out at the end of the day with his shopping trolley to collect odds and ends from the local streets in Collingwood to bring back to his garden to make it a beautiful, beautiful place. Because it wasn't just a garden, it was like a temple or a shrine. Mm. And this lovely, lovely chap had major, major mental health issues. And I remember we had to try and pull in the reins a little bit and say, you can't keep on bringing, you know, this ornamental clock, the statue, you know, the bits of fabric or whatever other ornaments he picked up on the street to decorate his garden. We had to draw a line somewhere. And there were some major issues in the garden, and the garden worker and the team from Cultivating Community said to this guy, look, you have to stop doing what you're doing. And things got a bit out of hand, and so he was out of the garden for a period of time. The Cultivating Community worker called me a number of times and said, you won't believe it, I've had this guy's psychiatrist calling me saying, please, you've got to get him back in the garden. That garden is his whole world, his whole life.
Right.
And the sooner that he can get his hands dirty again. And so now this man has got back into the garden and it's his whole world. And his family is so relieved and so thankful because every single day, morning until night, he leaves his flat and he's in the garden and he's a happy man.
Mm. You're starting to get some acknowledgement, I think, in some parts of the world of how important that is. I mean, when I worked in London for a time with the National Health Service, we were involved in getting funding, so government funding, health funding, and as you say, from you know, psychiatrists and general practitioners to fund people attending a community garden there, St Mary's Secret Garden. They do some great therapeutic work in East London. And for very similar reasons, to help support people with major mental health challenges, people who had very severe diagnosed mental health problems, or they might be recovering from trauma, people who had mental health issues tied up with hoarding and with space and physical environment, all sorts of things. And we were starting, when I left to get some success in accessing these government funds for this purpose, to help support community gardening, to help people with very specific health concerns. So I think there's a growing acknowledgement of that importance, and it's much cheaper to invest a very small amount of money in that and providing that access than providing, you know, emergency psychiatric care when people don't have access to that, as you say, and problems increase.
And as you said and Steve said, and we're talking about some sort of, you know, a reasonable recurrent funding, an amount of money that the organisation knows will come through every year so that we can continue to deliver this service. It's not just a one-off, planting this garden and making it look beautiful and then walking away.
Yes.
But it's acknowledging the incredible health benefits of that garden to people with very complex needs.
Mm. And I think, to reiterate that, you know, others have said similarly that it's that preventative care model. Mm. And if we will spend more money in the aftercare context with chronic health issues and illnesses and injuries and the chronic nature of that on our healthcare system, the impact that has on our healthcare system. But there are programs, there are locations, there are things that actually can help and prevent that. So that example you were saying, Basil, about that gent, was, you know, that's probably one of multiple thousands of stories that could come out of those that work across this field or around the world.
Exactly.
Of how that can actually, that program, that connection, that interaction can prevent so much more trauma, health issues, mental health concerns. So that's where we need to advocate for putting, you know, the programs like that, funding the on the ground, so to speak, using a good pun, but the ground level programs.
Well, I can reiterate just from my own experiences with talking to some of these gardeners in the community gardens. Many of them that I met were women who were on their own but had three or four children in tow. Now, they'd been sponsored out to Australia only to find it that their husband, who'd come, you know, 6 years earlier, had gone off, disappeared. So they were on their own trying to raise a family with very little or no English language. They'd come to these gardens, and so many of them said to me, these gardens, the garden is my saviour, because they'd come down, they'd meet someone else from their own nationality background, so they could start to learn a little bit about where to shop, where the local doctor who might speak their language is. But they'd also then broaden that to communicating with other gardeners in the garden, so their English language would gradually start to improve. They'd come down to the garden if the children, because they're all in these small housing commission flats, you know, if the children were getting to them, they could come down to the garden as a refuge for half an hour and sit in the garden. Many of them in summertime would all bring food down to share. So it became a social place to meet and get to know others in the garden, and it's just supported those people so much. The stories go on and on.
Yeah, it's the thing aspect of it that I love, and I mentioned before. The garden is there, but it's the layers behind it, all those aspects, all those levels of interaction, and that it brings. And I often use this very loosely when we say it's just gardening or it's just the garden, because it's not just. These programs in the garden and working in it are brilliant for connecting people and that people plant connection.
Yeah. Steve, recently I went to a garden celebration in Fitzroy where Peter Christensen from Cultivating Community and her co-workers hosted a garden party celebrating that particular garden. But, do you know, there was this incredible sense of celebration and coming together of people from very complex and difficult backgrounds and situations. And the garden was a uniting, that was a unifying meeting point for these people.
That's right.
But Peter was telling me she has actually just, Cultivating Community have got some funding for her to do, it's an exploratory program, looking at the potential of developing similar programs around food security and people coming together and sharing a meal in other disadvantaged communities. So in addition to the community gardens that Cultivating Community is doing, Peter has been putting a lot of work into the actual sharing of meals and people coming together celebrating the produce from the garden in a communal setting. And Cultivating Community have recently got funding for Peter to explore other potential sites across Melbourne where she can do this. So, you know, I feel like we're slowly getting the runs on the board.
Yes.
And when people see it's such a simple concept, people growing food, people growing plants and flowers together and then coming together and being able to celebrate.
And it's a celebration of their individual nationalities as well. They don't lose that because they're growing culturally significant food plants. They then cook with that produce, bring it down to share to the garden, and they can celebrate. I know there's been celebrations of Vietnamese lantern days things in some of the gardens. One of the stories I love to relate is one of the gardens in North Melbourne where the gardeners were primarily either from China or from Central and South America, and neither nationality could speak much English, but they really wanted to communicate with each other. Chinese, of course, was way too difficult for anyone to learn, but what they found was that Spanish was a fairly easy language, much easier than English, for the Chinese to pick up. So the whole garden was communicating in Spanish, which was just a wonderful melting pot of cultures craving to communicate and get on with each other and have that connection. So, yes, wonderful things come out of gardens.
Absolutely, Pam. And I think we've been very, very fortunate to see those extraordinary benefits of what gardens can give to people. And, do you know, just a little bugbear of mine at the moment are these poor, poor people on Manus Island. And I'm thinking of these characters who have been traumatised, who've experienced incredible layers of trauma. And I think, my God, if ever you could go and try and embrace these people and involve them in where they could create a beautiful environment, could make a colossal difference to their mental health and their well-being.
Mm.
But at the moment, we're just crucifying them, I think. Mm. Yeah,
absolutely. Josh, let's get back to you for a moment. Christopher, I mean, sorry. Chris, do you keep in touch with any of the other students that you went through school with?
Only on Facebook I do.
Oh, okay. Do you know if any of them, like you, are working within gardening?
No.
No one? They didn't follow through with that?
No.
Okay.
I think it's been pretty hard, Chris, trying to... I think a lot of those young people have had different work experiences, and it's been very challenging trying to get meaningful employment.
Yes.
But when Chris's mum told me that he actually had the opportunity to work as part of a garden crew over in the West, Chris shone out to me as a bright light. But there should be more opportunities like this for people like Chris.
Absolutely, because you said you've got students at the moment doing components of the VCAL process.
Yeah.
Is there going to be any work for any of them working within the industry?
Do you know a number of the young people at the moment, Pam, are doing placements with local council, Moreland, Darabin, and a couple of our boys from recent years and after Chris have picked up permanent part-time employment.
That's
with local
great.
Council, yep. You know, being part of the gardening crew.
Yes.
So, you know, there is a place for it and an opportunity, and we just need more and more. We need funding bodies to recognise, well, these guys can play an important role as part of that gardening service.
Absolutely. Do you find any of the students volunteer to come back and help in the garden at Croxton?
Do you know, Pam, I've had some wonderful students from the past who have done that, and but I do recall one of your listeners talking about kids at risk, and some of the kids who have really, really enjoyed the garden and really benefited enormously have been some of the biggest rat bags that I've encountered in my teaching career. Chris wasn't a rat bag. Chris was a good boy. But some of the kids who I still see today on the steps of Flinders Street Station call out to me and say good day, and they would often come to school on the day that they knew they had gardening because they loved to help me doing whatever it was that we're doing in the garden.
That's fantastic. Yeah, that's really good. Yeah. How do you see the future coming? What plans have you got with Austin Health?
Well, from that point of view, there's always the dream list of garden projects that I am keen to work. All the garden projects that we do are funded from external or non-operational means, so donations, grants, fundraising. So always interacting with people to tell them what we're wanting to do and achieve, and when we can, new projects will start. I'm certainly not on the delusional context of thinking that I'm going to be creating this botanical gardens, but what we're going to be doing is working towards creating more garden spaces around patient areas.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm also a bit of an optimist. I think that there's a lot of potential for creating more garden spaces and sharing that message, and for when future developments happen, that the green component, for want of a better word, the percentage of space that has meaningful green areas, meaningful garden spaces, are part of those developments, and that we don't just end up with more concrete and more concrete, but that we actually have spaces designated and set aside for people to come and enjoy.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like Austin Health actually value the role of hort therapy.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, the role of being a horticultural therapist and the Gardens and Grounds Project Officer are very left-field roles within public health.
That's right.
So I feel very fortunate to be in that position and driving that and being supported in that. It certainly wasn't... it was certainly because of the support of that at various levels that it started and has been developed and fostered. So very keen to keep that going and to very thankful that the organisation sees the benefits of that.
Mm, mm. Josh, plans for the future with Kevin Hines Grow and also with the other work you're doing?
Look, I mean, with Kevin Hines Grow, I think, you know, grow is the key term there. We've seen more interest in our student program for next year than we've had in previous years, so we'll be expanding the team. With a bit of an eye on the horizon to what happens with our space, of course. But, yes. Onward and upward, we want to get as many people as possible involved in the garden and make the best use of our facilities for the community that we can.
Mm.
And on a personal note, I've absolutely must finish my PhD next year. It's got to happen.
Where does... you're a counsellor in Monash. Where does the council stand in terms of providing gardening space, parks?
Sure, yeah. So one of the things I've tried to do over my year on council is really focus on things like community gardens and open space. We have a draft open space strategy at the moment, which has been out for consultation, which has been marvellous to actually see that happen. And we've had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of comments from people speaking about what they love about their local environment. We've got some really great pieces of remnant bushland in Monash. Damper Creek, for example, it's just marvellous, some of the work that's been done there. So, and people love it. They want to see it maintained. They want to see council acquire new open space to preserve public open space. They want to see our tree canopy be grown back to what it was and then some. So we're talking about setting targets for public open space, all different types of public open space being a certain distance from everyone's home in the municipality, and looking at setting a target of tree canopy cover back to 30%. So, look, we're doing some work on that, and if it's supported by my colleagues, we'll hopefully see that happen in future years. But they're some of the things I'm interested in working on at that level.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. What's happening in terms of developers these days, with planned housing? Is there any more push to try and get developers to incorporate in new estates and things, gardens?
Look, there is. It's a really difficult interplay, this issue between local government and state government planning guidelines. You know, we really need the support of the Victorian government, I think, so that local communities can clearly state what they want to see happen in terms of open space and vegetation and have that upheld at places like VCAT. At the moment, the state government planning scheme allows a lot of things to happen, and your listeners right across Melbourne will have seen sites go where, you know, just every piece of vegetation on a site is just demolished and the place is levelled, it's moonscaped.
Yes.
And then you'll see a single dwelling come in that's from fence to fence, you know, these large McMansion type houses, and that's really, really bad for the physical and mental health of the community. It's bad for the environment. It's bad for biodiversity. And I think it's well past time we had some better controls on these sorts of things. So I think it's a matter of communities making it known to their representatives at all levels of government that they want to see more green, they want to see more open space, they value gardens and they value the natural environment, and that's got to keep happening to see the change we need to see.
Mm. Have you got some sort of protection overlays against the remnant bushlands that you do have?
We do, but, again, at local government level, some of these are sort of relatively toothless. There's no threat to the remnant bushland that we've got. That's been well protected. But, we're talking about a very built-up municipality in terms of Monash. So the things that we really need to make sure that we protect are the significant trees and, make sure that we've got enough open space on private property and and public property to make sure that the people and the natural environment are both safe and well. And that's where we come into to some troubles, because as soon as you start coming up against against developers, you bring money into the question, and,
yes.
and that's where we all lose a lot of the time.
Yes. Wow. Basil. How do we get the education department more on side with providing these you know, not only school gardens but programs, incorporating them into the curriculum? I know that particularly with the Victorian Schools Garden Awards, this has been aimed at mainly teaching staff to get schools on side to see the importance and value of gardening within the schools. But how do we get the education department really, really throwing its weight behind it?
Look, I think, Pam, what VSGA is doing at the moment in terms of delivering a series of professional development days over the year that simply showcase the learnings and some of the great examples of school garden projects that are happening around Victoria, you know, and it has been challenging trying to do it, you know, when our funds are very, very limited. And most of these workshops have tended to be Melbourne-focused.
Mm.
But there are some wonderful, wonderful examples around the state of schools that are doing extraordinary work. And I think we just need to be showcasing and sharing those stories for other school communities to see what's happening around them.
Mm.
And people open their eyes and go, wow, look, you know, they have achieved this. And it does take, you do need staff who are passionate and enthusiastic and
That's
prepared
right.
to get their hands dirty.
That's right.
You need people who are prepared to push the boundaries. You need people who are prepared to occasionally fib and tell lies and, you know, do whatever you can to try and beg and borrow to make your project truly fantastic. But something that I'm very, very conscious of, Pam, is getting the schools where I work is actually getting the staff to actually do the work with the kids as well as me. I feel very, very important, very, very strongly that we need to be telling teachers and teacher assistants in schools, you may not have a horticultural background, you may not have a science background, but you do love the outdoors or you love that connectedness with nature, and we need to be encouraging teachers across the state more and more to be prepared to get out there with the kids and to go back to those very simple pleasures like digging and planting and harvesting and knowing that, you know, to plant some pumpkin seeds in a bed of compost is not that difficult. It's not that difficult. It's not rocket science. And I don't want to play it down, make it too simple, but, you know, planting a tree and looking after it is something that we can all do. And you don't need to have a specialist to come in and do that, you know. So I guess that's my hope for the future, is that more and more we can be opening the eyes of teaching staff around the state to the incredible potential that they have to deliver these programs to children in a way that works for their school community.
Mm.
I don't see there being one plan that fits all. Every setting is different but I think it comes back to passion and enthusiasm and people valuing that connection with nature and the natural environment.
Mm. We've seen time and time again programs where the program has been dependent on one enthusiastic person or one or two enthusiastic people, and if they get transferred or they leave or, you know, have to resign through ill health or whatever, the program falls apart. And I think, you know, you've hit the nail on the head. We have to encourage more and more people to have a go and be a part of it.
Yeah. Look, and just this week, myself and students from Croxton were working in the Royal Talbot Garden, and Steve, you might tell us a bit about Anton and the work that he's doing. It's always been great to see other people doing the sort of work that Steve is promoting.
Yeah, certainly. So Anton's one of the Allied Health assistants on the spinal ward, and has passionately started to develop a accessible kitchen garden program with the spinal patients, where it's about plant to plate. So using edibles, they then use that then within the kitchen context, because often they're doing cooking programs with the patients as part of their recovery and rebuilding. But also that there's the aspect of getting out in the garden, and he's working with them, and they'll come and do some watering and irrigating, and he's got different raised beds and different, starting to develop that further and further for people to get the idea of what they can still do and what they are able to do in their current situation, but work towards building on and developing for them also to have that knowledge and experience to take home and continue. So it's fantastic to see the evolution of that.
Yes.
And at the end of the day, sorry, going back to the school settings, Pam, too, I think it's the leadership in schools that plays a really, really vital role in the development of these sorts of programs because you can have somebody on staff who's very enthusiastic and passionate, but unless you've got a team of people around you, and in particular the leadership in the school supporting and recognising the benefits of what we've been talking about this morning, it's very hard to make that program truly sustainable. Whereas if you can embed it very firmly into the culture of the organisation, the culture of the school or the culture of the hospital, the potential of that program to truly grow and develop in future years will be colossal.
Pam, I'll just say on that point, I mean, I think that's exactly right. And one of the things that we try and do is provide those opportunities for people to really learn about how to use nature and horticulture in a therapeutic manner. One of the things that our Humanscape does is we run regular workshops, Introduction to Therapeutic Horticulture in the Workplace, and that is for people who work at schools or in a health setting who might want to develop some of those skills and help embed that in their workplace. As Basil said, if it's just one person, it can be quite difficult. But, you know, if people have an interest, and often you see that, if someone brings an interest into a workplace, other people think, oh, that's great, and they want to learn more. So we really encourage people to check out those workshops and come along. We've actually got one next Friday, but we run those regularly. So, you know, it's great for people who have an interest in learning a bit more how gardens can be used in that workplace setting.
Do you have the details about the workshop next Friday?
Yep, people can just, if they want to Google Humanscape or Kevin Hines Grow, they'll find those details on our website, or they can give us a call about that as well.
Okay, fantastic. And Basil, you used to actually be employed part-time by the department to run some of these workshops, and you were able to go out into regional Victoria, weren't you, to run workshops for schools in regional areas?
Yeah.
Do you think the department can be encouraged to go back to employing a project officer for this reason?
Do you know, Pam, I think there is colossal potential for that, and it's just a matter of you know, the powers to be who control the money to recognise the importance of these sorts of programs, because we're not talking about big dollars. We're not talking about all of the money that goes into high tech programs. We're talking about somebody who can try and work with schools to nurture something very basic that we all share, and that's a connection to the earth. So I hope Minister Molino is a pretty good guy. He comes from the same part of Italy where my family are from, a little group of islands off the coast of Sicily where there are some great farmers and gardeners. So I would hope that the minister might find some money in that kitty somewhere to support more and more of these programs and a statewide level.
Wonderful. Very quickly, because we've just about run out of time, we'll go quickly back to Jill. Good morning, Jill.
Hi, Pam. On Thursday, the Herb Society is having Marie Economides to speak about unusual herbs, and she's going to bring quite a lot to show, and if people want to buy them, they can buy them. And that's at Room 10 in Burnley Horticultural College, and enter by the steel ramp. And for people who don't know, it's 500, the Yarra Boulevard, Richmond, and we are also meeting at 6 o'clock at the big split gum picnic table near the herb garden for Bring Your Own Everything to Share picnic dinner if the weather's fine.
Okay.
So I hope to see some people there.
Great. Okay. Thanks, Jill.
Thanks, Pam.
Bye. Well, we have run out of time. I have to say a big thank you to the team, to all of you, to Josh, to Basil, to Chris and to Steve. Thanks so much for participating today. I hope our listeners have really gained a little bit of insight of just how important getting your hands in the dirt is, and go for a walk and hug a tree. Just be part of nature, because it's so important to our health and welfare. So thank you, everyone, very much. And I must also thank Vicky, who's been working the phones for many years now. Today is her last day. We couldn't have done it without you, Vicky. Thank you so much for all your time and effort you've given us. So, to our listeners, we will, of course, be back with our normal gardening program next week at 7:30. So tune in then. So until then, bye for now.